From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
March and march ahead, because ultimately the violent state and the corporate power doesn't know how to fight the non-violent people's movement. So if not today, tomorrow, we are going to win.
Tens of thousands fill the streets of Porto Alegre, Brazil, as the World Social Forum kicks off their message to New York, another world is possible. Then, is the World Economic Forum bad for business? Midtown Manhattan is locked down. The city's filled with the parties of the powerful and the elite. We'll talk with human rights activist Van Jones, being given an award by the World Economic Forum, Canadian activist Jaggi Singh, and Nobel Peace Prize winner José Ramos Horta. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. This is Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Pentagon officials have announced an investigation into claims of mistaken identity during a U.S. commando raid in Afghanistan. U.S. troops killed at least 15 people, took 27 prisoners in the raid last week. Some Afghans have said some of those killed and captured in the raid were not enemy fighters, but local officials loyal to interim leader Hamid Karzai. They say Taliban renegades were handing over weapons to Karzai's government at the raided site. U.S. military officials have insisted the nighttime raid by U.S. Special Forces targeted an ammunition storage site for al-Qaeda or their Taliban protectors. The Defense Department has launched an investigation but says it's too early to conclude the wrong people had been killed. The Pentagon's description of the raid, its target, and circumstances have changed over time. In a related development, Donald Rumsfeld says he's not yet ready to approve a resumption of prisoner transfers to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, where more cells are being built at a makeshift prison camp. Rumsfeld says he wants to ensure the base had enough room for new prisoners before he allowed more to be taken there. He also said he wants a better idea of how many prisoners ultimately will be held at the base. Estimates have ranged from 400 to 2,000. Interim Afghan leader Hamid Karzai left Britain empty-handed yesterday after British Prime Minister Tony Blair rejected his appeals for a longer-term commitment of British troops to Afghanistan. Karzai appealed to the United Nations in New York to increase the size of the UN-mandated force. As he met Blair, forces loyal to the interim government were fighting tribal enemies in the southeastern Afghan town of Gardez. The fierce clashes still raging last night have underscored the vulnerability of the interim authorities, whose writ barely extends beyond Kabul. Israeli police, still on maximum alert for new attacks, defused a bomb in an apartment block in suburban Jerusalem yesterday. Rebellion is growing among Israel's armed forces. More than 100 combat reservist soldiers signed a petition saying they would not serve in the occupied territories, posing a serious internal challenge to Israel. The petition has prompted a national debate and backlash within the army. Another group of several hundred reservists has signed a counterpetition accusing the petitioners of unbridled defamation of the army. Religious and human rights groups have accused the Australian government of running a concentration camp for asylum seekers and called for UN intervention in the country's immigration crisis. The accusation comes as Australian Prime Minister John Howard offered a cash payment to 4,000 Afghan immigrants, including over 1,000 in detention centers, to return to Afghanistan after he met Afghanistan's interim leader Hamid Karzai in New York on Wednesday. As emails sent Thursday to Pakistani and Western media purportedly by the kidnappers of Wall Street Journal's South Asian bureau chief Daniel Pearl extended the deadline for killing him by one day. The email sent from an account called kidnapperguy@hotmail.com said the Pearl abduction was not the end and threatened a real war on Americans, who it said will get the taste of death and destruction what we got, unquote. A similar email sent Wednesday had said Pearl, who disappeared January 23rd in Karachi, would be executed after 24 hours and demanded all American journalists leave Pakistan within 3 days or become targets. The group called the National Movement for the Restoration of Pakistani Sovereignty sent emails last weekend to news organizations demanding that Pakistanis held by the U.S. military at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, be returned before trial. The San Francisco Chronicle is reporting a memo outlining discussions between the White House and Enron reveals the extent to which the energy giant lobbied to influence government policy. The memo was handed by former Enron chair Ken Lay to Vice President Dick Cheney last April when the two met to discuss the administration's purpose to California's energy crisis. The White House acknowledged last night aspects of the memo resembled elements of Cheney's energy plan, but it refused to say whether the document was included in notes that Cheney now refuses to divulge to congressional investigators. A number of the positions in the memo subsequently made it into Cheney's energy plan or reflected in comments by senior administration officials. Meanwhile, in an attempt to limit the fallout from Enron's collapse, President Bush will propose measures today to protect workers like those who lost their pension savings while top executives reaped huge profits. In a series of proposals to Congress, Bush will call for barring executives from selling company stock during so-called blackout periods like the one that kept Enron workers from bailing out while the firm's shares plunged last year. And 2 days after the president called for nearly $40 million for Homeland Security, the Bush administration has warned that so-called terrorist networks may still be operating in the United States, requiring the nation to stay on high alert for perhaps years. And finally, yesterday morning at the crack of dawn, seven ACT UP activists were arrested while dropping two massive banners in protest of the World Economic Forum. We're joined now by Mark Milano of ACT UP New York. What were these protests about? What did the banners say?
There were two banners. Our banner said WEF response to AIDS, keep drug prices high, watch people die. And that's about the fact that corporations, including drug companies and others, you know, are not taking the steps needed to get the prices of these drugs down dramatically. They actually cost them about, you know, 2 or 3% of what they actually charge to make. And they've been fighting the production or importation of generic versions of these drugs to Africa and other areas of the world that need them. The other banner said, Bush and business agree people with AIDS drop dead. And that has to do with the fact that George Bush, who the administration had promised close to $1 billion this year for the Global AIDS Fund to help pay for even these drastically reduced treatments, and now announced that the budget will only contain $200 million to fight AIDS. And then secondly, the fact that big corporations like Coca-Cola announced that they were going to provide treatment to their employees with HIV and AIDS in Africa, and then revealed that it actually was only going to about 1,400 employees. All their bottlers and truckers are not official Coke employees. So truckers who were handing out condoms to people in Africa can hand out condoms supplied by Coke, but if they have HIV themselves, they will die without treatment.
Mark Milano of ACT UP New York, one of those seven ACT UP activists who were arrested while dropping two massive banners in protest of the World Economic Forum. Alligator lockjaw chainsaw, claiming your head, misled into a death trap, aiming to end the message I sent. It's clear, so stay clear before I creep through the trap door. Alligator lockjaw chainsaw, claiming your head, misled into a death trap, aiming to end the message I said. It's clear, so stay clear before I creep through the trap door. Attack pressure points until they senseless, useless defenses, misery's endless. The control room is vented, that's how I entered. Follow the rap to the capture, snap goes the trap, add suffering to your chapter. The master is sin, conclusion, phobia, illusions, 13 double strikes, mind slaves, race, evolution, burglar trap stages, trapping lying in filled cages, dying of starvation, eternal mazes. Retrace your paces, lost in the dark, memories vague, thoughts paralyzed, and infected with plagues, concrete structure, unsterilized acupuncture, pins in your face till you erase, alert the base. Initiate the chase, Mr. Two-Face, trapped in the staircase, cardiovascular running, then you were frozen in time, word grenades filled with rhyme, surrounded by... Trapdoors, DJ Sirius, here on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rules. I'm Amy Goodman, rejoined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez. Great to have you with us, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to all of our listeners. I've been absent for a few days during these momentous times here with the World Economic Forum, but I'm trying to finish up an investigation on the environmental problems of the World Trade Center that I've got to complete by next week. So excuse me for being absent for a few days.
Well, I look forward to the book and welcome you to the Los Angeles listenership of 9 o'clock as KPFK is back on board. And it's wonderful to be there at Pacifica Station as well as all the stations around the country. The World Social Forum is going on in Porto Alegre as the World Economic Forum has opened up here in New York, and we're going to be coming back here in a minute. But Juan, because of our remarkable producer, Chris Abrams, with help from Deepa Fernandez in Brazil, we are going to bring listeners now a view of the opening ceremony of the World Social Forum. Again, this gathering of tens of thousands of intellectuals, teachers, workers, peasants, social activists who formed a counter summit to the World Economic Forum. The first one took place last year, the gathering time to oppose the WEF. The slogan, "Another World is Possible." Yesterday, rush hour traffic came to a standstill as tens of thousands of people took to the streets for the opening march. The Democracy Now! Team is bringing us this report from the streets. We have received it on video for those watching on public access TV stations and on Dish Network Channel 419415, which is Free Speech TV. They sent it over the internet lines, this incredible video, interviews that they did with veteran Indian activist Mehta Paktar, who is with the Save Narmada Dam movement and the National Alliance of People's Movements in India. Mehta has risked her life at key points in the struggle to rid India of the large World Bank finance dams by performing civil disobedience and remaining in the sites as they were about to be filled with water. And she is also followed by Ananya Bhattacharjee of the Veach Foundation, and then Maria Luisa Mendonça, member of the organizing committee of the World Social Forum. This is the streets of Porto Alegre at the opening session of the World Social Forum. No, that wasn't a car honking. Here we go. We're going to go back to that tape later in the program. This remarkable technology may have some glitches. That's what grassroots globalized technology is all about. So instead of going first to Porto Alegre, we're going to stay right here in New York, because as the World Social Forum is taking place in Porto Alegre, the World Economic Forum got underway yesterday in a whirl of plenary sessions, security checkpoints, handshakes, and global luminaries. As delegates continued to stream into their midtown hotels, hundreds who'd already arrived began the circuit of panels and workshops. Among them, A Safer World, How Do We Get There?, Management Update, Making Hard Choices, and The Root Cause of Conflict. There was even a panel about artificial intelligence, something, as they say, for everybody. But the real WEF activities began in the evening. There was a welcome address by New York Governor George Pataki, the WEF founder and president Klaus Schwab, the Swiss businessman, speeches by UN Secretary General Kofi Annan and King Hussein of Jordan, President Gloria Arroyo of the Philippines. And there were the parties, elaborate exclusive affairs that included a private Elton John concert sponsored by Lehman Brothers and Vivendi Universal, produced by Quincy Jones and Phil Ramone. Performers allegedly included Lauren Hill, Brent Marsalis, and the ubiquitous Bono. Meanwhile, critics of globalization continue to organize throughout the city. We're joined right now by two of the activists, one who's on the outside and one who somehow made it inside. We're joined by Jaggi Singh, who is with the Anti-Capitalist Convergence from Canada, who's been arrested numerous times protesting there. And Van Jones. Van Jones is the founder of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, which challenges human rights abuses within the U.S. criminal justice system. He has won an award from the World Economic Forum. Can you tell us about this award and your feelings about it?
Sure. It's pretty remarkable. I think, first of all, I was one of the people who was breathing tear gas in Seattle in 1999. I got hit by a police car protesting the World Bank in 2000 in D.C. So when the World Economic Forum named me one of their so-called global leaders of tomorrow. I was pretty sure it must have been a typo or something, but it turns out that one of the benefactors of the Ella Baker Center nominated me, and so got the award. I think that what the award, for Paul Rice, who's been one of the big activists around Fair Trade Coffee and others, is a recognition on the part of the people who are the sort of global corporate elite that there is a stubborn counter current that's building. The critics of global capitalism are gaining in numbers and strength, and we have to be taken seriously even here. So I think that that's what the this Global Leaders of Tomorrow Award is all about. They're trying to figure out some way to deal with a huge global fact that cannot be ignored, and that is those of us who are vigorously opposed to the direction that these sort of economic royalists are driving the world economy and world society.
And Van, one of the things that interests me, especially with the World Economic Forum coming to New York City, they were clearly aware that not only were they expressing solidarity with New York City after the events of September 11th, but they would also be under a media spotlight unlike any that they have had in the past in all these decades. And it almost seems as if there's been an orchestrated attempt to portray the World Economic Forum as a sensitive body that is incorporating the movements of protest against it, that is listening to the voices outside, because I've seen in a lot of the news reports the liberal media figures like Warren Beatty and Ron Silver and the award they're giving to you. It's almost as if they're trying to create a new public image for themselves now that the cat's out of the bag as to what this organization is about.
Well, I think that's exactly right. It's a huge sort of PR campaign on their part. But they can't cover up the basic fact. And the basic fact is that you have 3,000 people who have more decision-making power in the world today than the 6 billion people they locked out. They cannot conceal the basic fact that you have 3,000 people who are meeting here behind closed doors, and you have demonstrations and protests and everything else and police like you've never seen. And yet 50,000 people are able to meet in Brazil, and it's peaceful, and it's because the 50,000 people are there not as protesters but as participants in an open process. The World Economic Forum is a symptom of a global crisis in democracy. And the World Social Forum is the antidote. And I think that, you know, there are certainly some honest people at the World Economic Forum, the reality is that until the basic power relationships have changed so that workers and ordinary people have the power to solve the problems at the grassroots level, the World Economic Forum is going to continue to be a corporate cabal trying to run the planet, hoarding power at the top. No amount of passing out awards and cookies and PR snow jobs is going to cover that up.
What are you going to say in your acceptance speech?
I'm going to say exactly that. And I think that the reality is we are in a situation in which there's no time anymore for pussyfooting around and biting our tongues. We have one small green soap bubble called planet Earth. All of the life support systems are failing us. And we have 6 billion people who are locked out. We absolutely must speak truth to power, and we must build power to combat this global elite that is dominating all decision-making for the rest of us.
Jaggi Singh, what are your plans? You made it across the border. That's a big accomplishment.
Yeah. Well, I'm part of a lot of other grassroots activists here in New York City and all over the country, all over North America, who've come to show clear opposition to the cynicism of the World Economic Forum, to be meeting in New York City and to be presenting it as some sort of solidarity with what New York has gone through, as if there's one interpretation and one way of interpreting what happened. What I find really disgusting is the idea that somehow to be protesting, to be opposing the World Economic Forum for many of the reasons that Van laid out, is to somehow dishonor the tragedy and dishonor the trauma that people have gone through. And as many people have pointed out, and I've written about this, as many New Yorkers have pointed out, it's New Yorkers who are making the call to oppose the World Economic Forum. It's New Yorkers who are coming out and saying it's so cynical and disgusting that they would sort of, as many have put it, hide behind the dead and try to co-opt what happened and use it to serve the purposes of global capitalism. And I think New York is a city that tolerates dissent, that not only tolerates it but celebrates it. And I think this, for me, is very inspiring. That here, where this horrible terrorist attack occurred, which has justified other terrorist attacks in the name of so-called democracy, in the name of so-called freedom, that there would be people who would take to the streets and engage in some fundamental opposition to the World Economic Forum. That's very inspiring for me as someone who's coming from outside this country. It's a way, as many people have expressed it, to say, to announce that the door that was open as a result of Seattle still remains open. And I'll be on the outside. I have no intent to go inside. I'm kind of skeptical. I'm glad Van won the award, I'm glad he's using it as a platform. But I'm skeptical in the way in which the World Economic Forum is co-opting certain progressive movements, using them as sort of the cover, the face of hiding their true agenda. And while they're giving awards to people like Van, they're also giving other awards that celebrate the future exploiters of the world. And they also call them global leaders and sort of, try to play that off. So I think we have to be skeptical of those efforts. And as Juan pointed out, I think part of that has to do with the fact that it's in New York and there's such a media scrutiny of what's going on.
Well, we're going to break for stations to identify themselves, go down to Porto Alegre, and then come back to you. We will also be joined by Nobel Peace Prize winner José Ramos Horta, who, along with Van Jones, is inside the Waldorf Astoria during these few days at the World Economic Forum. You're listening to Democracy Now!, our guest Jaggi Singh from Canada, the Anti-Capitalist Convergence, and Van Jones, the founder of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights in the Bay Area, California. Stay with us.
People are rising up. It is a global movement.
For justice.
Oh, what the?
For democracy, for social justice, and freedom.
For the right to protect our environment.
February 2nd, the movement is rising in New York City.
So bring your friends. Another world is possible.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan, we're going to try it again. We're going to go to Porto Alegre with this really cutting-edge technology, receiving quality video coverage of the first night of the World Social Forum, where tens of thousands marched through the streets of Porto Alegre. We received this just minutes ago over the internet. We are playing the sound and also broadcasting the images on cable access stations around the country, beginning with Maida Patkar, Save Narmada Dam Movement of India in Porto Alegre, Brazil. Well, we're going to keep on going. We believe we can do it here. I think it's coming. We think it's coming. We think we can. We think we can. Here it goes. You're listening to Democracy Now!
Much and much ahead, because ultimately the violent state and the corporate power.
No, we're not going to go with that sound, but we are going to bring it to our listeners fully well-developed tomorrow on our special two-hour broadcast, when we will have that rendered in full. Cutting Edge has its downside. We'll be going to the streets of Porto Alegre, Brazil. But we do have a room full of guests to talk about what's happening here in New York, and that is the World Economic Forum, a gathering of close to 3,000 of the world's corporate global elite. We are joined in our studio by Van Jones, who is with the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, Jaggi Singh of the Canadian Anti-Capitalist Convergence, and now with us, José Ramos Horta, Nobel Peace Prize winner, and I don't know if his title will soon to be Foreign Minister of East Timor, which will become a newly independent state on May 20th. And José Ramos Horta has traveled to New York for the World Economic Forum. I didn't expect he would be saying he was staying at the Waldorf Astoria. Somehow I thought he would be there on the outside, but of course I thought that with Van Jones as well. Welcome to Democracy Now!, José.
Thank you.
It's a privilege to have you with us. So what are you doing on the inside? What do you hope to get out of the World Economic Forum?
Well, first I have to say that I did come to New York to address a United Nations Security Council meeting, which was held the day before yesterday, all day long, on East Timor. And by coincidence, it happens that the World Economic Forum has taken place, so I decided to take up the invitation to me to take part, to address several workshops, several themes, one being very relevant to East Timor, and that is from conflict to peace. And also I will take part in some discussion on failed states. What would I want to get out of the forum for my country, for East Timor, is primarily to, I don't look at the situation in a very narrow way, concern only about my country, but my main concern is whether there is a chance for the two divides, the two sides of the globe, the poor and the rich, to bridge, to walk halfway, and eradicate poverty, malaria, tuberculosis. The rich cannot, will not be able to stay rich forever if they are not sensitive to the root cause of poverty and help the other side of humanity. On the other hand, I also believe that the poorer will not see their lot improve if we see the other side only as evil, as enemies. The two sides must learn to swim together, otherwise we all drown. That's my approach, and that's why I agreed to go there. I had been invited to go to Porto Alegre, but maybe my brothers and sisters in Porto Alegre are less well organized. I never receive any follow-up letter. I never receive any ticket to fly to Porto Alegre.
Well, I'd like to ask you, when in the mass media, when this debate is pictured at all as a debate, it's pictured as one between the forces of economic globalization, which are unstoppable, and those who somehow oppose the march of progress or the development of trade. But of course, clearly the movements that are opposed to corporate globalization in the way that it has developed don't see it that way. I'd like to get your understanding of the crux of the debate or the battle between the forces on the streets on the outside and those on the inside.
Well, you know, I come from a reality. You know, every day in my country and many other countries that I have been to share a lot of emotions with some African countries, Asians. We deal with day-to-day reality of poor people. Farmers who come to me and say the price of their rice cannot compete with imported rice from elsewhere. We see coffee price in New York, in Australia, very, very high. But then we are told that the coffee price is very depressed in the world market. In Australia or in the United States, you buy a kilo of coffee for I don't know how many dollars, but in Timor, they are buying for less than a dollar, and they say because the world prices. So the rich set the prices arbitrarily, the poor just have to produce and sell for the price that the rich determine. There is something wrong with that. And this is what has to be addressed by the international community, by the United Nations, the World Bank, to set fair market relationship between rich and the poor. But there are other aspects. There are many other aspects in terms of debt relief. We don't owe one single dollar to anyone so far. But it's heartbreaking to see countries like Argentina, breaking up, breaking apart, or Brazil or Indonesia. You know, how many times over these countries have already paid to the rich banks? Why don't we, United States took an exceptional leadership on to combat terrorism, and the U.S. Congress adopted a bill authorizing tens of billions of dollars to combat terrorism. But why then not the U.S. lead an effort, a global effort, to write off the debt of the poor countries, for instance?
Van, you wanted to chime in there?
Well, I just wanted to say make a few observations. One, I think, is that there is a great deal of concern on the inside of the World Economic Forum about the movements that we're all a part of. I just want to report from the inside. There's going to be a 4-hour session this afternoon on the anti-globalization movement. That is, I think, a direct result of the pressure that's coming from the outside. And I think that the goal of people like myself, the other guests, people like Bono, people like Desmond Tutu, is to try to split the forum from the inside, maximizing the pressure from the outside. There's a left, right, and center in everything. There's even a left, right, and center within the World Economic Forum. And I think we have done such a tremendous job on the outside raising the issues. We're certainly at a place now where we can move beyond opposing what these few tiny little global elites are talking about and really proposing our view about how it is that we can share this planet. And I think it's a golden opportunity, and I think it needs to be raised from the outside and from the inside.
Well, we're also joined on the telephone by Joseph Nye, who is Dean of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, where he's also professor of public policy. He returned to Harvard after serving as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the first Clinton administration. He helped kick off a forum yesterday on global governance, what needs to change. Later today, he'll be dealing with new priorities in U.S. foreign policy, featuring politicians like Senators Orrin Hatch and John Kerry, business leader Philip Condit, chair and CEO of Boeing Company. You have heard a lot of the criticism, perhaps, from the outside, Dean Nye, from the anti-corporate globalization activists about this group of more than 2,000 global corporate leaders. And I wanted to ask why you think the World Economic Forum is important.
Well, I think actually the World Economic Forum helps to get corporate leaders to see a bigger picture. After all, on day-to-day, they're worried about making profits for their company and so forth. What they do when they get to the Davos meetings, whether in Switzerland or New York, is have to think about larger questions of social responsibility and of questions of fairness, questions of global governance, and so forth. So I think it actually, from the point of view of the protesters, which is to complain about sometimes economic globalization being too narrow, actually Davos is a step in the right direction.
Well, Dean Nye, this is Juan Gonzalez. I'd like to ask you, in terms of that, some people would say that this is a more recent phenomena, that that in the early years of the World Economic Forum, they were more concerned about more business relationships directly and the structuring of the world as a global economic system, and that it's only as a result of not only the resistance in the streets in Seattle and in Washington and other places, but also the direct popular rebellions. For instance, in Argentina, the uprising of the Argentinian people that forced the collapse of their government, that is really what's been driving this new debate, or been at least bringing this new debate on the agenda.
Well, there's no question that the protests have accentuated this, but I've been going to Davos right through the 1990s, maybe missing a year or two now and then. But Klaus Schwab actually has been concerned about the social issues right from the start. There may be more attention to this now, but I remember Davos sessions well before Seattle, where these issues of fairness and global governance and how do you help those who are left behind were raised on the agenda.
Well, Jaggi Singh of the Anti-Capitalist Convergence in Canada
really
just come in for the protest.
I really think we got to see through the fog here. I really disagree with a lot that's been said up to now, and I've been sort of biting my tongue. First of all, corporations are paying $25,000 for the so-called privilege to attend the World Economic Forum. It's fair to say that this is the ultimate meeting of the world's fat cats. And then they invite certain people to make it look good. All right. These are corporations. These are processes that fundamentally cause poverty in the world. Right. And if we're talking about democracy, we should look where democracy is asserting itself. It's asserting itself in many ways in Porto Alegre. It's certainly asserting itself in Buenos Aires in Argentina. To talk about there being two divides, rich and poor, and we have to learn how to swim together. Well, the poor are poor because of that. Certain people are rich, you see. There's a certain agenda that's being presented to us, and we have to see through that fog. So the fact, again, I want to go back to the cynicism of this meeting in New York, and somehow and the party on Wall Street, of all things, a party on a grave that they're having, this ultimate fat cat party on Wall Street. These are all things
we have to really see through. Big soiree that's happening Saturday night
exactly.
at the New York Stock
exactly.
Exchange.
Exactly.
I would go further than that. It's not just that.
This is Van Jones of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights.
I mean, it's not just that they're fat cats. It sort of makes it seem like they're just sort of, you know, happen to be rich or whatever. These are people who are actively promoting an agenda. The World Economic Forum is a concentration of the ruling class. I mean, there's really no other term that can be used appropriately here. And the kind of internationalism that we're talking about is not a top down, profit making internationalism. The type of internationalism that's represented here is an internationalism that's grassroots. It's from the bottom up. The wisdom that's needed to solve the problems of this planet are not in the heads of these CEOs who fly over everybody with all their, riches. You know, it's the mothers. It's the working people at the grassroots level who see the problems close up, who have the wisdom, but who have been disempowered systematically by the people who are meeting at the World Economic Forum from solving those problems. And we will never be able to solve the problems of this planet, 6 billion people, with 3,000 people at the top, pushing their own agenda to make their own profits. I agree 100% with the other speaker.
Dean Nye, your response?
I think there's something in that, in the sense that you have to have bottom-up as well as top-down. But let's kid ourselves if we don't think that trying to tell the people who are on top that they have broader social responsibilities isn't useful. I mean, the panels that I sat through yesterday on bridging economic and social divides included the director of One World International in the UK, Thoria Obaid, who's the executive director of UN Population Fund, Minister of Finance of India, the Minister of Finance of South Africa. These were not people who were unconcerned about how you do things from the bottom up. And this morning, I was listening to a panel just before I joined here, which had Colin Powell and Hubert Verdreen and other prime ministers and foreign ministers talking about how do you get solutions in the Middle East. In fact, that's a whole dimension of globalization, which, as far as I can see, is not caught by the bottom up, which is how do you bring peace? I mean, I noticed that the places where I first met Nelson Mandela and Yasser Arafat were in Davos.
Ambassador Nye, I mean, again...
I'm not ambassador.
Okay, well, the fact is this is really disingenuous. The corporations, a lot of the political elites you're talking about, are actively involved in the repression of political movements that are showing that bottom-up democracy. There are corporations, there's too numerous to mention, who in the name of profit are going into various areas of indigenous peoples in the world and have been involved in a whole series of corporate crimes. When you talk about Colin Powell, we can talk about Henry Kissinger and these elites who have been involved in systematically dispossessing people all over the world. And, you know, we don't have the time here to go over every single example, but that's the fact. It's not a matter of trying to show a certain amount of social responsibility. Everybody knows that in person Colin Powell's great, and Henry Kissinger is a nice guy, and I'm sure you can get chummy with them. The fact is, what are the policies and what are the ideas that these people are responsible for that are actually dispossessing and outright attacking the people that are showing that bottom-up democracy? And we're seeing that in Argentina. And what's the response? The response is more austerity. The response is, we got to make sure we handle these people. The response is more militarization. The response is more jails. The response is a tremendous dispossession of indigenous peoples.
And then, a nice fancy conference to make it all look good.
Right, and a nice fancy conference with certain people who've done great things in their lives to sort of give it a gloss of somehow there's some social justice involved. And again, it's cynical and it's disgusting. And the people on the streets outside are going to try to show that.
We're going to break for stations to identify themselves for 60 seconds. That's Jaggi Singh of the Anti-Capitalist Convergence in Canada, came down to New York, is usually arrested at these events in Canada. We'll see what happens in New York. Van Jones, who's with the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, getting an award from the World Economic Forum. We come back with Dean Joseph Nye of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, who's running some of the panels. We're going to bring back in José Ramos Horta, Nobel Peace Prize winner from East Timor, a man who's been on the outside for a long time, protesting a government that's occupied his country, Indonesia, that has gotten tremendous support from participants in organizations like the World Economic Forum, and how he now feels being on the inside, staying at the Waldorf and attending this conference. Stay with us.
They're mighty multinationals that monopolize the oxygen, so it's as easy as breathing for us all to participate. Yes, they're buying and selling off shares of air, and you know it's all around you, but it's hard to point and say there. So you just sit on your hands and quietly contemplate your next bold. Next thing you're gonna have to prove to yourself.
Your next bold move. Ani DeFranco here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The World Economic Forum has opened in New York. Close to 3,000 of the global elite gathered at the Waldorf Astoria to talk about the global economy. There are thousands of protesters gearing up outside. At the same time, the World Social Forum is taking place in Porto Alegre, Brazil. It's the second one designed to counter what's going on in New York. The theme of that is Another World is Possible. Our guests are Dean Joseph Nye of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, in the administrations of President Carter and President Clinton, Van Jones of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights in the Bay Area, California, Jaggi Singh of the Anti-Capitalist Convergence in Canada, and José Ramos Horta, Nobel Peace Prize winner from East Timor. His country will become an independent country on May 20th. So, José Ramos Horta, as you listen to the two sides talking about the World Economic Forum, you've got those extolled like Henry Kissinger and others on the inside, and you have your own history. Indonesia, World Bank supported for many years, a dictatorship supported by many like those at the World Economic Forum. So what is your response to what is being proposed there this weekend?
First, I want to use this opportunity to Amy to invite you to attend our independence celebrations, but on one condition, that you only report the good things, positive things. I know it's going to be very hard for you to do that. You're always critical, always, you know, challenging, but for a change.
The relationship changes, José Ramos Horta, when you become a representative of the state.
Well, we might use the same blacklist that the Indonesians use. We might just adopt it. Anyway, it's great talking with you, Amy, seeing you again. You are always welcome, regardless of your state of mind when you're reporting on East Timor. My answer to you is that I have been involved in this struggle and have seen a lot in the past quarter of a century. And I have learned to refuse to be drawn into ideological dogmas. Sometimes the left believes that it holds a monopoly on the truth, on all the answers. In this regard, it's very similar sometimes to the extreme right. The two sides always claim to know the answers to everything. In the course of this quarter of a century, I have met some wonderful people from the left and some wonderful people from the right. And then there are many other good people in between. I haven't had much experience with the Davos process. I was in Davos last year. That it was then that I actually had the feeling that I was really a token individual there in the face of so many other people I saw there. And I had very, very little participation. I thought maybe someone by mistake or by accident invited me there, maybe to show off my face. Mm-hmm. But then I came here to New York, and I'm having a greater participation in several discussions, which for me is only say that people, the rich and powerful that you refer to, I think they are learning, they understand that the world cannot continue on this path with a greater poverty, which means instability. I think there can be a common agenda between the Porto Alegre and the people in the streets and the rich and the powerful, because they know, and that from my discussions with them, from attending some of the forums, and discussions outside the forum in the last few months, that they understand that the root causes of instability in many parts of the world is poverty, injustice. And if we do not address that, it will also affect their interests. They are not philanthropists.
Let me just say, with all respect, that I have been surprised at the level of understanding that exists within the walls. However, it seems very clear to me, and I don't know your observations, that the people who are there are not going to, on their own, take any dramatic steps to do anything about the problem. I think that they all feel very good about themselves for being willing and, to discuss these things. But I will tell you this, after the forums are over, after the panels are over, I don't hear people talking about poverty. I see people talking about business deals. I see people talking about the social things. I don't hear them talking about these issues. I want to say this, though, about our movement, because I think the most important thing that we can talk about is a movement against global capitalism. We have to be as sophisticated as the thing that we are fighting. One of the problems that we have and on the left is that when it comes to questions of strategy and tactics, we tend to be very unsophisticated. The bad guys are always trying to unite themselves and divide us. We have to be in a position where we can be uniting ourselves and trying to divide them. And I think that the mission of anybody who's a true progressive, who's inside those walls, should be looking for the weak spots, looking for the opportunities to raise our issues and to begin splitting the consensus that exists within those walls, knowing that we're playing a 1% role and the 99% role is being played on the outside. But that 1% role on the inside can be very important. If the bad guys can be sophisticated enough to have a Colin Powell, an African-American man, Condi Rice, an African-American woman, leading their war machine, we need to be sophisticated enough to know that we have to have a diversity of tactics and strategies ourselves.
Jose Ramos?
Yeah, I just want to continue my
yes,
thought.
Sir. Yes, sir.
My point is that, of course, the public protest, the pressure, has been very educational. It has raised the alarm bells in the rich countries. There is no doubt there has been a direct impact on the consciousness and the urgency felt by many rich. But at the same time, I want to say it here bluntly. While agendas that are articulated by organizations like Oxfam International and many others are legitimate, and I endorse them 100%. They would be endorsed by countries like South Africa and many developing countries. We must make it very clear that we do not condone trashing of public property, of cars, of windows, in Seattle and all over the world, in Prague, in Zurich. Let me just finish.
We should talk about the real violence. The real violence is the poverty, the structural adjustment programs, consistent day-to-day violence that is being perpetuated. And to compare that to cars being trash.
Can I finish? I live with poverty every day. I personally, from my Nobel Peace Prize money, I donated last year $154,000 to a microcredit. I deal with poverty every day. I take no lessons from anyone regarding what is poverty and what is war. I lost 3 brothers, 1 sister in this war. Few days ago, a Timorese came to me and said, "We know where your brother was buried." And for them, that was great news for me. Strangely, I said, "God, I'm so happy we found his body." So I know that. What I will not allow, will not condone, and will speak out, is some people go to the streets, trash public property in the name of the poor. It damages the cause, the agenda of the poor. Organizations like Oxfam International and many others, yes, who are those who make use of these forums in Seattle, in New York? Who are they? What is their agenda? Of course, there is no one is comparing the bombing of East Timor for 25 years with the trashing of the, but you just don't do it. My family was killed. We lost a quarter of a population in 25 years, and never once we killed one single Indonesian civilian, and never once we trashed one Indonesian property anywhere in the world. That's the difference.
Jackie Singh?
Well, I think this is playing into the divide and rule tactics that we're talking about. You talk about, look at the uprising in Argentina. It's not very clean and nice. It's sometimes messy. People sometimes target the clear symbols of corporate property. I'm not here to marginalize the experience that Jose has gone through. I'm here to talk about resistance. The fact that resistance takes multiple forms. I'm not here also to justify people trashing property. I'm here to talk about real violence in the world. Real violence in the world. Okay, and people who might decide to throw a rock at a Nike store, that might make a good photo op. Poverty doesn't make a good photo op. Okay, structural adjustment programs don't make a good photo op. The ways in which we have a militarized world, the ways in which at the World Economic Forum, what's being promoted is corporate profits for some of the most largest arms companies. That's real violence. Jose, you've gone through a long struggle, but certainly you don't speak for all Timorese, and there are other Timorese who speak out about the way in which the IMF and the World Bank are moving into East Timor to take control, the way in which you can gain political independence and you can gain self-determination. But if you don't have economic independence and economic self-determination, then political independence becomes very meaningless. We have to ask those critical questions. I was involved in my own way as someone from Canada in solidarity work, and you don't forget your ideals. You stand by those ideals. And I think we have to show a certain amount of solidarity with resistance that's being shown in all its multiple forms worldwide. And that's not a justification for violence. That's recognizing where violence is perpetuated from and the fact that people react to that violence.
We go back to what I said. Some people think they have a monopoly on truth, on ideals.
Well, what I'd like to do is I'd like to bring in Dean Nye again into this conversation over precisely this issue of economic fairness and economic equality around the world. You recently had an article in the Boston Globe on the whole issue of globalization. The Globe reprinted it as "Globalization Can Turn Back Terror." And in it, you said that if the current political backlash against globalization were to lead to a rash of protectionist policies, it might slow or even reverse the world's economic integration, as has happened in the past. One of the things that is a touchstone of the whole debate over globalization is this issue of lowering tariffs and opening up markets. But the my understanding of the economic development of the West is that most of the great powers, whether it was England or the United States or Japan, in the period of their rise to economic power, were involved in protectionist policies. And in fact, that even in the Third World, which is obviously the issue, the main issue of opening up markets for the Western countries, that even in the Third World, there was far greater economic progress, lower polarization of wealth and economic development during the period of import substitution in places like Mexico and Latin America and others in the 50s and 60s than there has been during this period now of imposed and pushed a lowering of tariffs in the third world. So, I mean, it's not a question of globalization. It's a question of globalization on what terms.
No, I agree with that. In fact, the argument that's in the op-ed is spelled out at greater length with more subtlety in a book that's just being published this month called The Paradox of American Power, Why the World's Only Superpower Can't Go It Alone, in which there's a chapter on globalization. But if you look at the, it's not, you shouldn't open up everything or close off everything, but if you look at the situations in the world today and ask what's happened to countries that tried to close themselves off, the North Koreas, the Myanmars, they've done miserably. If you look at countries that have opened themselves up, relatively speaking, which includes the South Koreas and China, actually, you'll find that they've had spectacular growth. There are a lot of poor people in China or South Korea who became far wealthier.
What you'll find, sir, is that the rich in those countries have done very well for themselves. I agree with that,
that's
sir.
That's right. But notice the following proposition. The cliche is often that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer as a result of globalization. The rich get richer and some of the poor get better off. And one of the ironies we face is that as you reduce poverty, you often increase inequality. So if you look at China today, and start with the fact that hundreds of millions of Chinese peasants were miserable. That was their original condition. There are hundreds of millions of Chinese peasants today who are actually have escaped misery. Just let me finish it. But because there are other Chinese peasants who haven't gotten out of poverty, the net result is that while China has tripled its GNP, including many people in poor areas in China, inequality is increased at the same time.
Just have one thing to say. Watching the rich get filthy rich and hoping some of that will trickle down to the poor is absolutely no vision of a humane world.
And I hope in someday with time that your view will come true. But what I'm asking you to consider is if you compare China in 1980 before Deng Xiaoping's relative opening with China today, there are hundreds of millions of Chinese peasants who are a lot better off for that opening.
Sir, your analysis unfortunately leaves out the questions of the environment. It also leaves out the questions of culture. We're not just economic creatures here.
One of the things
I think, sir, that people are rebelling against is the imposition of a monoculture, both at the level of the ecology and the environment, and also at a human level. And globalization is a process of erasing what's beautiful about the planet and replacing it with McDonald's, parking lots, and money for rich people.
I agree that environment and culture are equally important. And in 30 seconds on a radio interview, you can't answer that. If you look at the book, The Paradox of American Power, that I just referred to, there is discussion of both the environmental and cultural effects. And there are some good effects and some bad effects. And what we should be working on is how do we diminish the bad and increase the good. But the idea that it's all black and white just isn't the way the world works.
Well, on that note, we have to wrap up this discussion. Dean Joseph Nye of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard speaking to us from the Waldorf Astoria, where the World Economic Forum is taking place. Here in our Firehouse studio, Van Jones, founder of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights in the Bay Area. He'll be getting an award at the World Economic Forum. Will be interesting to play his speech. Jaggi Singh, who's come down from Canada with the Anti-Capitalist Convergence, and José Ramos Horta, Nobel Peace Prize winner from East Timor. Tomorrow, a two-hour special, Democracy Now! Will be broadcasting at noon Eastern Standard Time. Radio stations around the country can broadcast us when they want to. The question, is another world possible? You can go to our website at democracynow.org. In Los Angeles, a major forum on the issue of the World Economic Forum, globalization and militarism. You can call the Office of the Americas. In New York, major protests in the streets, Students for Global Justice, the Anti-Capitalist Convergence, and others will gather at Columbus Circle tomorrow at 11:30. That does it for the program Democracy Now!, produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, with help from Lizzie Ratner and Deepa Fernandez. Anthony Sloan, our music maestro and engineer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
The military and the monetary get together whenever they think it's necessary. They turn our brothers and sisters into mercenaries. They are turning the planet to a cemetery. The military and the monetary use the media as intermediaries. They are determined to keep the citizens secondary.